The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's savings specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank. The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Ireland's savings specialists. Rabodirect, the straight-talking savings bank.
Áine Lawler here for Marion. Good morning. First of all, a very big thank you to so many of you who got in touch about Paul Reid, who was talking to us last Saturday. I'm really glad so many of you enjoyed listening to him, and just to repeat, our very best wishes to Paul and his family, and thanks again for talking to us. Now, in a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking to another person I think a lot of you will be interested in. That's Lieutenant Shane Mulcahy, who just arrived back in Cork yesterday after the LE Aetna completed that hugely demanding but vital life-saving mission of rescuing migrants in the Mediterranean Sea. We've also got Rock Dave and Classical Dave, Dave Fanning and conductor David Brophy, the domestic divas on shifting serious bathroom grime with homemade remedies. You don't need tons and tons of bleach. And I've been road testing the recipes in my own bathroom. There's commitment for you. We'll be finding out about the Irish Time team searching for the Spanish Armada in Clare. Plus, singer-songwriter Julie Feeney has arrived back from walking the Camino, so she'll be talking to us about that and might even sing us a song or two. So if that weren't all enough, we have tickets for Van the Man, Van Morrison in 3 Arena next November to give away in our competition. That's part of his 70. Van the Man is 70. It's unbelievable. But anyway, he's still brilliant. If you want tickets, stay tuned. That competition coming up after 12. And if you can at all, stay with us for the next 2 hours, 1850 715 150, or you can text 51551 or marion@rte.ie for your emails. Well, the headlines this weekend: Ireland to take 600 extra migrants in EU initiative is what the Irish Times leads with. But the big surprise, I think, to a lot of people is a picture of W.B. Yeats there and their other big story, Who Rests Under Ben Bulben? But it's not Yeats. Papers confirm bones sent by the French were not actually all the authentic bones of W.B. Yeats, and Lara Marlow has a big piece on that in the Times today. The Examiner, an absolutely fantastic picture, a simple headline, No Place Like Home, and it's Sophie and Dylan welcoming home their dad, David Buckley, as he and the rest of the crew, Ellie Ethnic. And you can just see the happiness. It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Bribery claims probed at eight hospitals is the Examiner's main story, and also rebels urged to ditch Confederate flags at matches. The Irish Independent also has another fantastic reunion photograph from the LEE Aetna's return to Hall Boleyn. But their lead story is to do with property. Property ladder misery as house prices soar. And property also the lead in the Irish Daily Mail. Mortgage cap fuels new surge in rents. Unable to buy, people pour into the rental market. And really, people being caught between a rock and a hard place on a lot of that ones. To turn to the tabloids, and the Weekend Herald and the Star both lead with the McQuillan family's grief. This is following the sentencing of Paula, or the conviction of Paula Farrell yesterday for the murder of Wayne McQuillan last year. And Imelda May is making the lead then in the Irish Sun and the Irish Daily Mirror, her marriage breakup. Let's turn to the English newspapers. A lot of people pick up a copy of those at the weekend. Top city financial regulator quits is the Financial Times lead. But given all the talking we've been doing about banking crises in Greece and, you know, huge figures like 80 billion being thrown around the place, you know, there's been this massive stock market run going on in China, and there have been big questions about that. Well, the Financial Times says today that the Chinese state-owned banks are propping up the stock market, so effectively bailing out the stock market, to the tune of $200 billion dollars. So something pretty big going on in China. Also an interview with the Italian left-wing comedian and politician Beppe Grillo, who says the corrupt don't think that they're corrupt. In the Telegraph, something that holiday time of years, and they have this on their front page, not the main story obviously, but one I think a lot of people will be interested in. A holiday drive gets heated in 2 hours and 37 minutes. And this is Britain's Highways Agency. So they did a survey of families and cars on a hot day and how stressful it gets. And apparently it takes 2 hours and 23 minutes before the children start saying, "Are we there yet? Are we there yet?" And then 14 minutes later, arguments start to break out. So the recommendation from everybody, certainly the British Highways Agency, is that you plan breaks at 2 hourly intervals and the kids won't be upset. Well, lots of kids, obviously, as you can see from the papers, delighted to have their daddies and in a couple of cases, mammies, I think, back. And that's the return of the LE Aetna to Holbolan Naval Base at Ringaskiddy in County Cork yesterday, 9 weeks after they left to play their role in the mission to rescue those migrants who's fleeing from Africa and the Middle East for a safer future in Europe. Lieutenant Shane Mulcahy is in our Cork studio. Lieutenant Shane Mulcahy, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Anya. It's good to be back.
We saw the pictures from the point of view of everyone on the pier, and it looked so bright and colourful, and, you know, the LE Aetna coming steaming into Holbolan there. What's it like for you guys up on the deck?
That's a fantastic experience. I mean, just sailing into Cove and into Cork Harbour. I mean, Cove is a beautiful, picturesque city from the, or, you know, town from the ocean front anyway. But to come in and see and mostly hear the amount of people there to watch us come in was really fantastic. And more so, I suppose, to hear our own ships sounding their horns as we arrived in. It let us know how important it was to the Navy as well.
Yeah, they were fantastic pictures and certainly making a big splash in the papers today. And those pictures of families being reunited, it just occurred to me it must be so much more precious to so many of the crew, given, you know, that you had to rescue so many children.
I certainly know that a lot of the guys would have felt that way and would have drawn similarities to some of the families we would have seen on board with their own family at home. And as hard as that can be, I think it brings guys comfort as well. I know a lot of the crew would have commented on seeing these families with young children of similar ages to their own and thinking, you know, how distressed these people must be to put to sea in such a life-threatening situation with such young children. And at the same time, I think a lot of the guys, and myself included, would have felt very proud that we were able to help them in those situations.
3,337, that was the final tally that the LE Aetna rescued, is that right?
That's right, yeah. We conducted 22 operations over the 9 weeks, with just under 3,400 rescued, and of that number, over 500 women and over 160 children. So the children would have made up, I think, over 5% of the total number.
And I know you had to do huge preparations to get ready for this mission, and you'd brought nappies, but it turned out you really did need them.
That's it. I mean, setting out from Cork, I think we left on the 16th of May. There was a very large element of the unknown. I mean, We really didn't know supplies-wise what we would need, and it was a case of it's better off to be looking at something than looking for it when we got down there.
How long was your checklist? What kinds of things did you think, that you wouldn't normally bring?
Oh, from nappies to baby food, medical supplies were a huge part of it. Personal protection equipment, I mean, it was something we didn't know we would need as much of, but we're glad we brought was burns. Kits, burns gels and burns creams because of the number of chemical burns on board the vessels.
Chemical burns?
That's right. The rubber craft and the wooden barges, especially because of the design of them, a lot of the women and the children were seated in the middle. And the middle being the lowest part of the boat is where any excess petroleum and seawater would gather. And so salt water and petroleum would make quite a caustic mix on the skin, and they'd be sitting in that situation for over 24 hours. So we would have seen a lot of maybe second degree burns on some of the women and children. And that's something that the medics luckily were prepared for and were able to deal with.
So you've done your long list of preparations, not knowing quite what you're heading into, and you head off to the Mediterranean. And the Mediterranean, to most people, we imagine it as a nice sunny place where you go to have your holidays and lie on the beach, and the sea is always peaceful. What's the Med like as an area of operations from a naval point of view?
Well, I can confirm it is definitely sunny. The heat down there was something we did our best to prepare for, but I don't think Irish people, we commented and joked a few times that we were turning into a puddle of freckles and white skin. We did our best to prepare for the heat, and we did quite well. The sea conditions, luckily, were not comparable to what we're used to dealing with on the west coast of Ireland, and that really stood to our benefit. I mean, our ships do upwards of 160 days at sea a year regardless, and that time is spent doing various marine enforcement roles, and that time spent at sea gave us a
serious lead up. So you had plenty of experience, and people weren't afraid of the conditions from that point of view. And in terms of, you know, getting distress calls and responding to, would you just, you know, go out and patrol and pick up whoever you saw, or was there liaison going back with base, and, you know, you're told to go to a particular spot, or how would that work?
Well, we had huge cooperation with the Italian Marine Rescue Coordination Centre, which was based in Rome. We would spend our times in the area of operation conducting surveillance. So we'd be using additional visual lookouts, radar searches to try and detect any craft in distress. Of course, listening out on VHF radio emergency frequencies as well. The Marine Rescue Coordination Centre would keep constant contact with the ship and would inform us if any vessels were detected. If they heard of or got news of a vessel in distress, they would contact us and direct us to it. The size of the area of operation was quite large, but for a ship of our size, we were never more than a couple of hours from any one particular vessel. We were able to get out there, assess the situation, and conduct a rescue accordingly.
And when you'd get there and you'd see, first of all, the business of transfer, I mean, very often these weren't particularly seaworthy vessels, I'm imagining. And the business of transferring people, that's not easy, especially when you're dealing with children and elderly and sick people.
I mean, of the two types of vessels that we generally dealt with, one type was a small rubber craft, about 8 to 10 metres long, and it's it was designed just purely out of rubber and plywood with a small, maybe 40 or 15 horsepower engine on the back of it. And into this small boat, they would have over 100 people. And I mean, that doesn't give room for life jackets. It doesn't give room for heavy weather. And in some of these cases, the weather had kicked up when we arrived to rescue these people. So it did make things a lot harder for us. Right up to the wooden barges, which generally, the wooden barges would have been quite seaworthy had they not been crammed full of, you know, upwards of 300 people. So balance and keeping the boat calm and everyone seated even was hugely important.
Yes, because I can imagine, you know, a lot of people would see a naval vessel coming to rescue them. And then how do they end up in such a distressed state? Because in many cases, they've only been at sea for a day or two. So it's hard for many people to get their heads around how quickly, you know, people can get physically stressed. And I imagine many of them aren't in great shape when they're getting onto the boats as well.
Well, that's true. And I mean, you mentioned a few moments ago, 2 hours is enough to do it in a car. I mean, these people over 24 hours crammed with no room to even move for over 24 hours in many cases is enough to get very stressed. And on top of that, knowing that they're there with their children, I think, is an additional factor. And that was a big part for us. Once we did have people embarked on board the Aetna, we realised very quickly that by calming the children down and by giving the children some toys or some colouring books to play with, it calmed the children
down. Had you brought those with you as well?
You know, that's something that, in fairness, the crew themselves prepared for. We thought of a lot of the logistical things we would need, but the crew went out on their own back and bought boxes of colouring books, pencils and toys, and brought them themselves and gave them out to some of the first kids we encountered. And as soon as we saw the effect that had, not just on the kids, but on the parents, we knew that this was an important part of the rescue. And so by the time we made it to a port, the Defence Forces had provided further toys and colouring books for us for further on rescues.
Oh, that's really sweet. That's really touching that people can be so kind. I know they're doing their duty, but it's the extra kindness and humanity on top. And we've all heard the expression, but you literally had to clear the decks of the LE Aetna.
Well, that's it. I mean, the ship is designed for flight operations. It has a helipad, and I think that helipad has seen use that we never really expected to see. At one point, I think we had over, I think it was 647 was our maximum number on deck at one time.
647.
So that's almost 10 times the crew capacity of the ship. And just to give you an idea, we had people on the forecastle, which is right up the very bow of the ship, right down to the very aft parts, lining the sides of the ship, filling the flight deck, as I said. I mean, there was people everywhere, and we needed to be very aware of, and that was a big thing we trained for, was not just crowd control, but people management on a large scale, keeping people calm. And, you know, as I said, if kids are happy, if people are fed and they understand that they're being looked after and that they're on their way to somewhere safe, it makes a huge difference.
The other issue, especially, I mean, more than 600 people on board, how sensitive did you have to be to separating out people who might have been traffickers or exploiters or people who needed to be questioned by the authorities, possibly in from a criminal point of view, from those who were simply trying to escape for political or economic reasons?
It was something that we were very aware of, actually, going down. It was something that we put a lot of consideration into, and we did a lot of training for beforehand. When we did get into the area, having spoken with the Italians and the Maltese and a number of other nationalities working in the area, we discussed amongst ourselves and looked at different other operating methods. But when we would have a rescue on board of, you know, of these people, we'd look at the nationalities and they would separate themselves generally into their own family groups. Women and children we kept separately for the most part. But any problems on deck were very, very quickly resolved. And it was key for us that if there was any arguments on deck between people, the sooner we dealt with it, the better, because it would prevent, you know, a large argument ensuing. So any arguments dealt with quickly and calmly. Everyone stayed calm. We gathered information on board, and any photographs we took and any intelligence we gathered from the vessels and the people on board, we passed on to the Italian authorities. And a key thing for us was that our mission down there was humanitarian and search and rescue, and was to save lives. And we knew that part and parcel of that was the Italian mission, which was also to put a stop to the people trafficking and the human smugglers. So any information we gathered and intelligence that we found, we passed on and cooperated very closely with the Italian authorities.
So it's your job to rescue people. You did so in as observant and prudent a way as possible. And then it's the Italian authorities who act on that information.
Absolutely.
There's a good Dan has sent us in a question for you, Shane, saying that he's very proud of the Irish Navy. And here, I think all of us say that at the moment. And of course, we're remembering that the Ellie Neave, isn't it, has gone out and is on a second mission. So, you know, the work goes on. But a question from Dan for you, Shane, is the personal protection gear, you know, the white suits and the face masks. Dan is asking that while it's understandable, it did make you look intimidating, and did you find that an obstacle in calming people, or were there ways of communicating gently with them?
That's actually something that we put a lot of thought into. And it was when we were doing our initial training, we realized very early on, it is an intimidating a feeling approaching a ship and even a small boat coming at you with everyone on it dressed in white protective gear. You can't see their eyes, you can't see their face. And that's the most intimidating part of it, I think. Key for us when we did get them on board was, you know, staying calm. And even something as simple as sunglasses, preventing someone from seeing your eyes. By wearing goggles instead of sunglasses, and someone can see your eyes and they can see that you're smiling or see that you're calm, has a calming influence. The wording we use when we go on board the vessels, using small words and telling them, you know, to stay calm, we're bringing you somewhere safe, you're now safe. And that's something we repeated a lot, was sit down, you're now safe. And of course, when we did get them on board, and it's something I said before, that I think Irishness does have a part to play in terms of, we can be serious and we have a job to do and we will do it, but we can have a smile on our face and we can do it in a way that isn't intimidating and isn't threatening. And mm-hmm. that did have a large part to play.
And just by the way as well, Shane, you mentioned that as much as possible you kept the women separate, and you had some female naval officers, isn't that right, who were able to deal with the women as needs be?
That's right. We had two females on board, one army medic and one a leading seaman and non-commissioned officer on board. And their role was vital in terms of the initial embarkation of personnel. They would have been helping with safety searching and frisking essentially to make sure that nothing dangerous was being brought on board, and from a medical point of view in triage and urgent medical care. So both of them would have been very busy, and it's something that I know that the NIAF has considered and has also made sure that there are female members of her crew as well.
Right. What about counselling for the crew? Because I know that, you know, you're being very upright and naval and all the rest of it today. But I know that the crew did see some scenes that will remain with some of the people forever.
They will. And the thing to remember is that while this is the first naval service humanitarian mission abroad, it's certainly isn't a first for the Defence Forces. The Defence Forces have been involved in overseas peacekeeping missions since the 60s. So there is a Defence Forces system that is very, very effective and very well thought out for personnel support services in terms of talking to people, understanding what they've done, what they've been through, what they've seen, and just talking about it and having an understanding of it. And before we departed the Mediterranean, members of the Defence Forces personnel support services flew out and joined the ship and actually sailed back to Cork with us and talked to the crew and made sure that everybody understood what they'd been a part of. I think luckily for us, because of the type of mission we were involved with, it was in many ways a feel-good factor in terms of we walked away from this, everyone had a feeling of achievement and a feeling of pride that yes, we had seen people in very distressing circumstances, but we had been there to make those circumstances better, and we did so. And so I think in general, the crew would have walked away from this feeling very good about themselves and very proud of their accomplishments.
Well, I think, and as I say, an awful lot of people are proud of the job that you have been doing and that indeed, as you're reminding us, is continuing. I'm hearing a trace of an American accent there, Shane. You're from the States originally, so if so, how did you end up in the Irish Navy?
That's right. I think my colleagues will be saying you're hearing more than a trace. I was born in upstate New York. I moved to Ireland when I was 12 years old in 1999 and grew up then in Watergrass Hill in North Cork. So I would have a definite split nationality there, all right.
But not divided loyalties, I take it.
Not at all, no. I've adopted my new home country with open arms.
And the Navy itself, the Irish Navy, what drew you to it? Because I think it's great to see the recognition that the Naval Service is getting for this mission in the Mediterranean. As you say, the Army has been recognised for a long time for its peacekeeping work, but maybe people wouldn't have taken the Irish Navy so seriously in many cases up to now, would they?
Something I've seen, even in the last 24 hours of being home, people who would have talked with my friends and family and who wouldn't know that I was in the Navy, and hearing the Navy as a subject of conversation, that was key for me, is that, you know, this has become a story that isn't a localized thing for us, that of course anything that happens in the Navy is big news to us that are involved in it. But knowing that it's in the national media in a way that has never really happened before, we're all proud and we all feel a certain amount of happiness that this is something that we have felt we've been able to do for a long time. And we feel that, you know, it's the government asked us to step up and play our part, 10 weeks ago. And we did it, and we did it well. And there should be a certain amount of recognition now, I think, amongst the country that, you know, we have a Navy that we can be proud of and that can play its part on an international scale. And that's something we saw ourselves working with the Italians quite closely, the British, the Germans and other nationalities in the Mediterranean, having them turn around and look at us and say, wow, you know, you guys are good at this. You are well able to play at this level. And that's something that we're all happy about. And we all felt that we can definitely do this again.
Hear, hear. Those are very fine words. I'd say your wife was very glad to get you back, though, wasn't she?
Well, I like to think so. I'm, you know, that's a big part of it, is coming home and knowing that you've been away for 9 weeks and having loved ones at home who miss you. And you know, that's something that we're used to in the Navy in terms of our normal operations would be 4 weeks at sea at a time. And 9 weeks, yeah, it's a lot longer, but yeah. We like to think that absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Well, certainly I hope there's a lot of people finding that out at the moment. But in your own case, was it hard? Because I know Kate had had her own difficulties with health and she'd been going through difficult treatment. Did that make it harder to make that decision to go on a 9-week mission?
It did, absolutely. About 5 months ago, Kate was diagnosed with thyroid cancer, and so it was a hard decision. She had her surgery and her treatment, and it was difficult in terms of from a job and career point of view. This was a huge opportunity, and it was something that I would have felt strongly mm-hmm. about wanting to play my part and be involved in. And Kate was hugely supportive of that. It wasn't an easy decision. It was something we made together, and of course, there was times while I was away that she was talking to me and emailing me saying, you know, I don't know if I made the right decision here. Yeah. But no, I think we're both very happy that that it's something I was able to take part in. And I know both of us are happy to be home now and to be finished, you know.
Well, fair play to her courage and to your courage. She's doing well at the moment, is she, Kate?
She is, absolutely. And she I tell you, she received absolutely amazing treatment in the South Infirmary Hospital here in Cork. And it's something that... you know, she's in the medical profession herself, and we both feel ourselves to be first responders to some extent, but to have seen the care and the work that was done in there is truly astounding.
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, you can be the person providing care one day, but you can be the person needing care another day. So it's great that it's there. Well, as I say, she's very brave and you're very brave and the whole country is very proud. Can I ask you one thing before you go, Shane?
Absolutely.
Why is it lieutenant? We were practicing lieutenant all week because, God forbid, I would say lieutenant, which is the way it's spelt, of course. Why do we say lieutenant?
Well, I tell you what, Anya, coming from America where it's lieutenant as well, something I struggled with, and I can assure you it's not a mistake I'll make again at work, is referring to myself or anyone else as lieutenant. But
it's a real no-no, isn't it, in the Irish Navy if you do that?
Well, in the Army as well, there's an Army rank.
Yes, of course, lieutenant, yes.
That's right. And so, I think it's nice that there's a certain Irish twist on things, and other countries, when we work closely with them and they refer to us as lieutenant and they hear us saying lieutenant, it is an oddity, but it's something that I think we're all a bit proud of. Even there's some things that are international in militaries, but Ireland always retains its individualism.
Well, listen, it's just been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. I wish you and Kate and everybody else and all the families of all the crew on board the Ellie Aethna the very, very best. Our thoughts, of course, with the Ellie Niamh, which is heading out to the Mediterranean now, and good luck to them. And the Ellie Roisin, there'll probably be a third mission, is that right?
It's what we're being told now. Which ship will follow the Niamh, if any, hasn't been confirmed yet, and we don't know. I think that the Niamh should be arriving into the area of operations about now. They have their work cut out for them, but the fact is they're the same crew as us. They have the same training, the same attitude as us. It's a different ship, but I think they're going to do an extremely, extremely successful job. And they're a faster ship than us, so... you know, we all really look forward to hearing more about the Niamh, and we all, on the Aetna and on the Naval Base, we really do wish them the absolute best of luck.
We leave it there. Thank you so much for talking to us today. Lieutenant Shane Mulcahy, thank you. Back after the break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.